Hello, I am Taboo.
And my name is Church.
And we are the Dark Souls 2.
And welcome to the Dark Souls 2, where we're going to discuss the upcoming game by Bandai Namco called Dark Souls 2.
Yeah, and all things Dark Souls, I suppose, but key focus this year is going to be on Dark Souls 2 for sure. So, are you excited?
I'm hella excited. I mean, who didn't like Dark Souls 1?
Well, probably many people, but yeah. This is a game that I have been following very closely for at least a year now. It's actually ruined every game since, because I've just been highly anticipating this game and just waiting for it.
Absolutely. And because we've been following, and because there's a lot of hype, there's enough information that we can have a discussion with you, the listener, about what's entailed in the game, what we think is going to happen, and what we know is going to happen, because there's been a beta release, people were playing it, there's a lot of trailer videos about the different classes. Well worth having a think about what's going to happen, whether you want to invest in it, because, I mean, if you're not going to buy it, what the hell's wrong with you?
High hopes, Scott?
Absolutely. I mean, the first game was wonderful. Demon's Souls was even better.
I have to disagree with you on that, but that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm all for people enjoying both games.
Demon's Souls was spectacular. And Dark Souls wonderful too. But Dark Souls 2 looks in every regard to be better. And I think one of the main things about Dark Souls that set it apart from, you know, the other games of its time was that it was just unforgivingly difficult. It was meant to be hard, and it ticked that box really, really well. And Dark Souls 2 looks, by all accounts, to be even harder.
And we'll hit a lot of those points as we go on. Right, so from the beginning, for those that have been obviously following Dark Souls as closely as we have, we're going to hit a lot of the points that you may or may not know, and a lot of things that I'm sure you don't. For those that are sort of new to this but are just getting caught up in the hype now and are anticipating it, we'll hit the sort of core things that everyone should know.
Right, and as the game is released and we play through the levels, we'll take you through what we interpret, the way that we see the lore unfolding. Those that have played Dark Souls will understand these are games where the lore isn't force-fed to you. In fact, my initial complaint about Dark Souls was that there was no storyline. And I wasn't interested because there was no storyline. And it actually took Taboo here telling me that there is a deep storyline. You just got to pay really close attention, getting me back into it and getting me appreciating the depth that this game has. And so I think it's well worth having someone on side that's paying attention to the lore, is consistent, and is reporting back to you on the way they see the storyline developing.
Yeah, for sure. And as I understand it, you definitely have a mind more attuned to those things than I do. I've learned a lot, and I'm going to try and focus really hard on that because I find the lore just immensely interesting. But to those that felt the lore in Dark Souls, or less so, but Demon Souls, was lacking.
Take your point, and I totally agree.
It's there. To explain it to you. It's there. It's there, and in hordes, it's just you have to really, really be looking for it.
Mm. And that's the thing about the Souls series. You've got to work for what you're going to get. You've got to work to stay alive. You've got to work to finish the game. And you've got to work to understand what the hell's going on around you, which I really like.
So as we go through this, we're going to cover what you need to know about the game. And then towards the end, we're going to hit a few points that we've collected over the last year as we focused in on the game. But I think before we go too far, it's worth pointing out that it comes out on the 11th of March for North America, 13th of March for Japan, and for the rest of the world, Europe, Australia, 14th of March.
That's right. The rest of the world is just Europe and Australia.
So I'm pretty excited about the actual editions that are coming out, to be honest. Do you want to touch on them a little bit?
Yeah. Which one did you pre-order?
I pre-ordered the collector's edition, which...
Yeah, sounds like you.
Fair dent out of my pocket.
Yeah, $169 Australian dollars for the collector's edition.
Yeah.
It's pretty steep for a game.
It is, absolutely. And for any other game, I'd feel like an absolute dunce for doing it. But last year for my birthday, my darling girlfriend bought me a nice 12-inch statue. She found this guy that was commissioned by Bandai Namco to make a few limited run statues from the game, and he detailed them perfectly.
You know, they told you it was 12 inches long, but if you didn't trust them and you weren't quite sure, you could have taken it in the shower. And if it's four times longer, then you're actually, never mind.
What?
No, never mind.
Okay, sure, I won't talk about my 12 inches in the shower. Thanks, Scott.
Oh, I was talking about four, but anyway.
Right, well, all I was getting at is I've already got this amazing Black Knight statue, which if you're interested, I'll probably take a picture and throw it in the link dump at the end. So yeah, this time around, when I realized that it was coming with another awesome statue of the warrior from Dark Souls 2, I couldn't resist. But that's not all yet. At risk of sounding like a late night salesman, you've got in the collector's edition 10 starting items, which is an interesting thing for a Dark Souls game. They're actually giving you extra starting items when you start the game, no matter what class you start with. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how they handle it. It seems like all of the starting items in the game are going to be findable in-world.
They are.
So there's nothing unique. And if you have a look at the pictures of them all, they're all a normal-looking shield and weapon combo with a bunch of junk hanging off it. So some of them have these, like, golden crystals all over them. Some of them have this, like, black slimy stuff, which I think is kind of interesting.
So they've been, like, dipped in some sort of a goop, or they've been forged with heaps of slag still on them or something like that. But, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. We'll see how it plays out. I'm assuming there's no real benefit to having them at the beginning, because I'm guessing there's going to be requirements to use them that you won't be able to do from the get-go. But it feels out of character for the game, to be honest. Dark Souls always rewarded you for exploration, and these items are already in-game to be found. So I don't want to get them at the beginning. I'd rather find them myself, you know, in their place.
Yeah, well, they're so ugly that I don't think I'm going to use them. Aesthetics is very important.
Okay, for you maybe. So yes, 10 starting items. It comes with a metal case, which, nice touch, but no big deal. The soundtrack, which is always nice. The same music producer as the last game, which is excellent, because I think the music really made the game what it was. The boss fights were all unique, and the music was just excellent.
And the lack of music as well.
Yeah.
In some areas. Rather agree.
And also that's all for the Black Armor Edition. So just to cover that again, we got a little confused there. The Black Armor Edition is the pre-order edition. Comes with the 10 items, a metal case, and a soundtrack. And it goes for approximately $90 Australian or $60 American. And then the Collector's Edition comes with the same stuff, plus a cloth map, an art book, and the 12-inch Warrior Knight figure.
The issue with the previous game was that it was a console port, and anyone who's a member of the PC Master Race will understand why those two words are dirty words. This game is not a console port, it's a PC port. They've made it for PC, they're porting it to consoles, but there is still no release date on PC as yet. Now, the game comes out in less than 2 weeks. Why is there no release date for PC? No idea, but I'm closely anticipating that one.
Yeah, it's good news. Basically, they've come out and said that this time around, rather than going from console to PC, that the whole thing that happened there was it was an immediate success on the consoles, albeit a little cult classic, I guess. It was still a success on the consoles, and the PC crowd sort of said, look, we want a part of this as well. What can we do to get it? And there was a petition that was made, because Bandai Namco pretty much said, look, we're not against the idea, but we'd need to know that there's an interest. So a petition was made, and within the first, I think, 2 days, there was 90,000 signatures. So they went, yeah, all right, bugger it, we'll make it on PC. And they sort of knocked it together. It wasn't their focus. It was well past a year after the initial release. So they got it out there, which was great, like, that they're listening to their fans and would do that for their fans. But they have come out and fully admitted that, you know, it didn't have the polish that it deserved. There was frame rate issues. There was texture size issues.
Tony Murray described it as sort of half-assed.
Yeah, which comes straight out and says it. You know, a guy working for FromSoft saying he acknowledges that it was half-assed. But this time around, not the case. They've actually focused on PC. They've designed it on PC and made it for the consoles, I suppose, would be the way to come at it. That's not to say that the consoles are going to suffer. And your little quip about PC Master Race earlier, fair and valid point. We're both PC players. But to make sure that we're on top of things and releasing news in a timely manner, we'll both be playing on the consoles on the release date.
Absolutely.
On that note, before we go too far, I think we should make it clear we're going to be conscious of giving away spoilers. We're not going to sort of out and out, you know, ruin everything for the game, but be aware that we're going to be touching on so many little aspects that no great storyline spoilers will be given or anything like that. We'll be cautious, but we're going to cover a lot of things, so don't be put off.
So, the game world in Dark Souls was called Lordran, and it was a country-type area that was massively varied. There were forests, and there were cities, and some of the cities were totally different to the other cities, and there was some urban decay. This time, we've got what looks to be a relatively similar setting, but a totally different location called Dranglake. Interestingly, every time they mention Dranglake in the trailers, there's a long shot picture of a city, and flying over it are what could be drakes or wyverns or dragons. in vast numbers. So mm-hmm. interestingly, it seems like dragons are going to play a part in this game.
Yeah, so dragons have been confirmed to be a big player in the game. It seems to be like the common meme these days in games, dragons. But, you know, we always know that Dark Souls has taken their own path, so it's not going to be a boring trope. But yeah, the way I've heard it described is Dranglake was a city that's surrounded by walls. So it seems very closed off from the rest of the world. I'm not sure what that really means yet. Definitely feels as though it's a game that follows directly on from Dark Souls. But even that's a bit of postulation. I don't know if we know if it's before or after. Well, or
time in the Souls, at least in Dark Souls, has always been a bit wishy-washy. In fact, they even go some lengths to explaining why the character returns to life after dying. And it's a question of the curse that is afflicting humanity. You know, you die and come back to life so many times, you eventually become insane and turn into what's called a hollow, a person that's fully lost control of their faculties and is aggressive and seeks souls. And so the fact that time is always so all over the place in the Souls series suggests that this could be a prequel, could be a sequel, could be some kind of sideways thing that's totally, it could be contemporaneous. Who knows?
To those that played the DLC for Dark Souls, I think the best analogy I've had brought up is it's Dranglake to Lordran is as the Royal Woods were to the forest in Dark Souls. So
you mean Darkroot Garden?
Yeah, Darkroot Garden, the forest. Anyone that played the DLC in Dark Souls that got to Royal Woods would have noticed that there was definite similarities between that and Darkroot Garden / the forest. The easiest way to describe it is as though it's an era after the happenings of Dark Souls. But again, we have to acknowledge that the whole time situation with the Dark Souls universe is a bit wibbly wobbly.
And when we talked earlier about the walled off city that's fallen into disrepair, and you know, there's the curse afflicting it, it's reminiscent of Boletaria from Demon Souls, which obviously, you know, this is a spiritual, the Souls series are a spiritual successor of Demon Souls. And I think it's very interesting. I think they've gone back to their roots. There's one thing they do particularly well, and they keep doing it, and I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, definitely. If you played Demon Souls to Dark Souls or vice versa, there's absolute similarities between the two. In other games, it would feel as though that it was just lazy programming. They've just found something that works and stuck to it. But it never really felt that way between the two games because there was such unique differences. And I think that'll be the case between Dark Souls and Dark Souls 2
and
as well.
Speaking of differences, there are some significant differences that I think are going to change the way you play Dark Souls 2. For example, the first one that springs to mind is the fact that you can warp to any bonfire that you've rested at. So as we know in Dark Souls, until you get the Lord Vessel, you have to walk between bonfires. And of course, there's those really innovative little shortcuts. What do you think about that?
I'm actually a bit apprehensive about it, to be honest. I like the idea of being given this right from the get-go. It sort of opens up the world to a degree, I suppose. Any bonfire you find, basically, you can warp to. Even in Dark Souls, when you got the Lord Vessel, you couldn't warp to any bonfire. Some just didn't have access to. So with this, from the get-go, you can warp to any, which the reason I'm apprehensive is because I found the first half of Dark Souls was much more enjoyable to me than the second half when you got the Lord Vessel. That's not to say the second half was crap. They definitely rushed some areas, but just the fact that you didn't have to travel by foot between every area. Mm-hmm. And that was such a huge aspect of the game that I loved.
And I think the reason that I like that particularly is because you can visit an area and later on you need to pass through it. You still got to fight all the enemies there and sometimes they kill you.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. But the thing that I loved about Dark Souls is that you could travel from one side of the world all the way to the other side without having a single loading screen, which having the ability to just warp sort of eliminates that. You're not going to be spending as much time in areas. Potentially, you may pick up on less things due to not being as observant through playing the area over and over again. It's a small change, but we'll see how it works. I mean, it's not going to put me off the game by any stretch, but it's interesting sort of.
Absolutely. I mean, and we don't know how they're going to handle that. You know, we have to have a degree of faith in the people at Bandai Namco and From because they're quite, you know, they've made some fantastic games.
Yeah, I think we absolutely do. We wouldn't be here talking about it today if we didn't.
Another change that I think is interesting is you can always be invaded. So in Dark Souls, if you were a hollow and you haven't consumed a humanity at a bonfire to become human, then you can't be invaded. You are immune from people invading you. The problem there, I suppose, is that they're rewarding you for being undead. Whereas in the new game, you can be invaded any old time.
Yeah, which again is a massive change to the way PvP is going to be done. And there's a few more major changes that I think will really, really make that face of the game so much more interesting. So, as you said, you can be invaded at any point, which also means that you can summon help at any point as well. So, again, not sure how that's going to play out entirely, but it does mean that you're going to get people that will just constantly be trying to invade. Now, for those people, it's not a hopeless case. You know, that there's going to be built-in punishments for people like that in the game. There's covenants that are designed to track down ritual invaders that aren't doing so well, that fail. There's punishments for failure when invading. There's also covenants, like the Way of the Blue. So for people that are off-put by this thought that they can be invaded at any point, there's covenants designed to help them. So don't go playing offline just so you can't be invaded. Go join a covenant like the Way of the Blue. And what will happen is when you get invaded, it'll immediately summon two other people from this covenant to be sort of bodyguards for you and help you.
Or from an affiliated covenant, it seems. It seems that the Way of the Blue are the people that need defending, and the Guardians of the Blue, or sometimes called the Azura Guardians, the Blue Sentinels, the guards, you know, who are summoned from their own gameplay into your world to look after you. Another interesting thing as well is that you're not going to get ganked by people that have a relatively low soul level, but have been playing long enough to accumulate a bunch of really good armor, because matchmaking now is going to be based not only on your soul level, but also on how long you've been in the game. And when we talk about skill, we don't mean the number that's displayed on your stats screen, because as we'll touch on later, the combat has been updated to the point where it seems like players that have played the game for a long time are going to develop genuine skills that allow them to, you know, to defeat people in PvP. And obviously Dark Souls was like that, but not, I think, to the same extent. Another interesting point on PvP is that they've got their own dedicated servers now, and they can be region locked. So you're probably not going to have massive lag spike issues, and it's not going to turn into this game of exploiting the fact that, you know, the other guy's pinging out.
Yeah, compared to Demon Souls, if you ever try to invade someone in Demon Souls, it worked almost every time. Dark Souls, it was just it was a lottery. You know, am I going to get an invasion tonight? I don't know.
Having said that, worryingly, a lot of the videos that we've seen that show gameplay have a soapstone sign on the ground, and the person displaying the gameplay will go and try to activate it, and then straight away it'll come up on the screen. You know, summoning has failed, the soapstone has disappeared, which is a worry, but I think overall it's going to be much better.
I think it needs to be acknowledged that, well, for one, they may have been summoned by somebody else, which is why their soapstone disappeared. But also the footage we've seen is early betas of the game. It's not going to be a true representative of I guess, the final product.
Sure. Now, we touched earlier on the way that combat has been changed. I think that's worth touching on because, you know, the whole point of the game is to fight the baddies and cut them up with the knife. I think I'm really excited about the way that things have been changed. Firstly, I think dual wielding. I mean, holy crap. I like to play a caster, but watching the dual wielding gameplay and reading about it makes me think it would suit me, actually, to do that kind of high dexterity, dual wielding, you know, really unique kind of gameplay. What do you think?
Yeah, so there's the class, the dual wielder, and basically the changes to that are, it's not just sort of left hand shield, right hand sword, as the last few games have been. It's a much more viable class to play now. Basically, you have the ability to play with left handed slant, so you can have a shield in your right hand and a sword in your left. That still works.
And for southpaws like you and I, it's pretty decent.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice little touch. Also, you'll have this power stance, which I don't think either of us have fully come to terms with yet, but the long and short is,
I don't know how I'm going to handle it.
Yeah. Demon's Souls, you'd press triangle or Y to swap between single-handed and dual-handed, whereas with the dual wielder in this game, it's going to have some sort of a power stance where you hold the triangle button down.
And you enter into a power stance which changes combat somehow. Now, they're talking about both weapons swinging at once, but the videos that we saw explaining this, which will be link dumped at the end of the at the end of the podcast, there'll be an opportunity to look at these videos, doesn't seem to display that. So up in the air about how that will actually play. Of interest to me as well is the way that backstabbing has been upgraded significantly.
Oh, God. Like, you mentioned the way the servers have changed with having dedicated servers this time. That's one huge aspect to PvP. But I think the next biggest is the way they've overhauled the backstabbing in this game. In the last game, as we are all aware, for anyone that ever did any PvP, it just turned into sort of a lag stab, chain stab fest, where if you didn't know how to defend against a backstab or pull off a backstab, you're going to get ganked every time. Whereas in this game, they've fully overhauled that. Okay, so basically, now it's a punishment for making a mistake almost. You can grab somebody by the back and then pull off the backstab, but the grabbing animation takes time. So you can't just run up, get behind someone and bust an R1 and pull off a backstab every time. They have to be standing still for a moment and you have to pull off that animation. You are vulnerable while doing that animation as well. So if they have support, like say they're in a way of the Blue Covenant, and they have two bodyguards, and you go for the backstab, whilst trying to grab them, one of their friends sort of swings their big gnarly axe at your face, it will still contact, and it'll disrupt you while trying to pull off this backstab. It also means that while they go to do something like pull off an Estus because they're choking and struggling, if you do manage to get up behind them, they're going to be still for long enough for you to punish them with a backstab. It's not just going to be a R1 to win sort of a game anymore.
More strategic, less tactical by the sound of it, if you know what I mean. It's less about just trying to fight for that one particular thing of happening to be able to lag stab the guy. Magic. Magic has been overhauled. The new magic looks amazing. And when I say magic, I'm just lumping pyros and sorceries and miracles in together because there's been upgrades to all of them. And I think the way they're going to play it is really, really interesting.
Yeah, so it seems sorcerer classes are a much more viable playstyle now. Not that they weren't viable in Dark Souls. They're almost a easy mode because you could always stand back and just soul spear.
Yeah, as long as you don't want to do soul PvP, arrow. You'll be fine.
Yeah, but come PvP, there was some overpowered spells, but it was difficult. Whereas now, they've done so many changes to magic as a whole that it almost plays entirely differently. For example, you don't have just a restricted amount of casts each time you sit at a bonfire. It now takes from your stamina bar to cast a spell. So it means that if I've got a full stamina bar, I can cast. Oh, look, my stamina's gone down. Wait a moment for it to charge back up and cast again.
You still do have a limited number of casts, but you can obtain items such as what's called an amber herb, who I think is dating Johnny Depp. and that replenishes your number of casts. As has been said, if you're a well-stocked caster, you could potentially have infinite casts. You keep picking up the amber herb, and like Johnny Depp did, and you get more casts to add to your total number.
Yeah, so it's sort of like Demon's Souls for those that played it. You had an MP bar, a Magicka bar, and as you worked that down, you could take an item and it would charge your Magicka back up. It works the same way except for the amount of spells you can cast each time you sit at a bonfire. So taking this herb will recharge that and allow you to cast more all the while taking it out of your stamina bar.
Absolutely. And speaking of spells, it seems like some or all spells have a weak and a strong attack and some can be charged. Mm. Now, I think that's really interesting because if you think about the Dark Souls experience, you sit at a bonfire, you get 20 soul arrows. Those 20 soul arrows, if everyone hits the opponent, translate to a certain amount of damage. That's no longer the case because you can do the fast, you know, fire off the fast soul arrow if soul arrow is chargeable and do a little bit of damage. Or if you play more tactically and you give yourself the time to charge them up, you can do more damage. So it might be that changing your playstyle a little bit allows you to use the resources you already have to beat enemies that you couldn't otherwise beat. Another interesting thing is the dual wielding of catalysts.
Mm.
Now, how's that going to change the game? I'm not really sure. But having a catalyst in each hand seems kind of cool, right?
Yeah. So it seems as though there may be some sort of an overcharge ability when dual wielding catalysts. I'm not sure entirely how that plays off, but I'm guessing there'll be some aspect of adding the Magicka adjust of each catalyst together in some way and performing an even stronger cast. And also you have the ability to manually aim spells, sort of like aiming an arrow, bow and arrow in the previous games. You sort of get a crosshair and you can go into first person and manually aim them.
Because how frustrating was it to see an enemy and think, well, my strong spell is heavy soul arrow, but I can't attack that guy because I'm He's not able to hit him range. With the spell. Very frustrating. Speaking of spells, and when I say spells, I'm including, again, miracles. There are some really, really innovative spells that you didn't really see the likes of in the last game. When they released Halo 3, and
go
they had...
On. And Where's they
had,
this going?
You know, they had all those equipments, like the bubble shield.
All right,
And yep. there was some healing thing or whatever. What they said was, this isn't about winning the game with these items. It's about changing the game dynamics, and you have to use them tactically to win. There's a spell called Dark Burden. It's a miracle. And I'm really interested in this because what it does is you cast it and it generates an area around you that you can move in and out of where gravity is heavier. The gravitational force is heavy there, so the enemies all move slower. And I think you move slower as well because one of the other things is you'll be affected by your own pyromancies and your own spells. So if you're in the range of a put the explosion of a pyromancer, you'll get hurt. So if you cast this spell, which doesn't necessarily allow you to win, because if you're in that area, I imagine you're going to move slower too, but it changes the game dynamics. So if you use it cleverly, then you're going to do well. I think those kinds of innovations are very, very interesting.
Yeah, I suppose what you're describing is more utility spells over offensive spells.
There's another thing that I found really, really interesting that I think might surprise you. I actually haven't encountered a game that does this before. It's called Dexterous Conversion. Have you heard of it?
No.
So imagine you're a spellcaster and you rely on intelligence. Dexterous Conversion turns your intelligence points into dexterity points. Let's say you encounter an area where the enemies are really close up and they keep attacking you and you don't have time to cast, or you don't have the range to cast, or you're just getting slaughtered because spellcasters tend to use really light armor, which obviously you don't have to in the Souls series, but you'll tend to. Then you can activate the spell, turn your intelligence into dex, and for that area, for that short period of time, become a hand-to-hand fighter.
Wow. Okay, so again, something that just makes that class so much more viable.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Spells that change your stats into other stats, I hadn't encountered that before.
Sure, and I'm sure games do it, but to completely swap the class almost mid-game, just for a small period of time, I'm assuming while you cast the spell, will absolutely change the way you can play, I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I really agree, and I'm very interested in being a caster now just because of that.
Well, on that note, how are you going to play for your first playthrough?
I think I'm going to be a caster. I mean, I want to be that dual-wielding guy because I like that kind of... It speaks to my kind of fighting style of moving about in and out of range and sniping the guy. But I think I've always played a caster in everything, all the Elder Scrolls games and the Demon Souls and Dark Souls, and I've got to do it. What about you?
I don't know. It's a hard decision for me to make. I think I'm going to have to play some sort of a variation on the sword and board this time. While I like the idea of pyromancies and spells, I just don't think you get that intimate feeling with the game and that intimate knowledge and tenseness you get from taking on bosses when you play as a caster. So I think this first time, just so I get the very minute emotions from the game and the way bosses feel, I feel that a sword and board class is the most natural way to play these games.
Yeah, look, I certainly understand your point, but I think video games are about what you would do in a fantasy world, and who the hell doesn't want to do magic spells?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Gave me this wry look. There's a bunch of other stuff that we've kind of come across in our travels and that we've seen that we think we're interested in how it's going to play out, or we think people ought to know. For example, we mentioned earlier you can... have your shield in your right hand and your sword in your left. And if you're a left-handed person, then it might look more natural on the screen for you to do that. You're also able to riposte with the shield. So you can strike the person with the shield. You can backstab someone with a shield. You can do a jumping attack, I assume, with a shield. So the shield is a viable weapon. Obviously, the damage is going to be nearly as good as the sword. But I kind of like that they've made... It's a bit more realistic.
Yeah, there was actually some gimmick classes that came out of Dark Souls of dual-wielding shields and PvPing in that playstyle. And it was... It's the kind of thing that comes out of a game that people know inside and out and have played for hours and hours and hours on end just to change things up a bit. But this time around, it actually seems like it could be viable.
Absolutely.
Having dual-wielding shields or even two-handing a shield and pulling off like a devastating sort of blow when you knock down an enemy with a parry.
There's a really good trailer for Demon Souls where a knight uses his shield like a weapon. And you couldn't use your shield like a weapon in Demon Souls. It kind of makes you think when you watch it, how realistic is that? And I think it's quite realistic. If I was a knight, I'd probably want to end up using my shield as a weapon at some point. So I kind of like the fact that they've added that realism.
Mm, you always had bash, I suppose, with the heavy shields, but now you can really bash someone.
And we'll link dump that video because holy damn, it's cool.
Yeah, now look, I mean, one of the things that I've definitely noticed, one of the things that stood out most to me when I started watching gameplay videos was the way they've changed the lighting in this game. It plays such a strong role in the game compared to the last few. But not only that, because it plays a strong role, it has actually been a focus of their system and their engine when they've made the game. So there's a lot nicer transitions when you walk into an area with different lighting or darker lighting. It's not just this jarring, if you pass this pixel, suddenly it drops to 20% brightness. And if you take one step back, then suddenly it's full brightness again, like it was in Dark Souls. Like when you're walking from the Valley of the Drakes into the swamp and it sort of changes the lighting
jarringly.
So. Jarringly, yeah. So with this, there's shadows that actually flow naturally and there's nice transition. So I really sort of took to that the moment I saw it in the videos.
And I've got to say, we're at a point in gaming where we shouldn't have to be amazed by good flowing natural shadows and good flowing natural lighting. But in a game that's as immersive as this, it's important to say that's going to work well. And I don't like things that break the immersion. And when the lighting suddenly changes, like when you enter Blighttown, all of a sudden it's just as dark as hell, it ruins the immersion to a degree.
Yeah. Now, even so, with this one, it's going to be an environmental hazard too. So there's going to be bonfires where you actually have to pull out a torch and ignite the torch to proceed into an area sometimes, or even light the torch off a sconce on a wall or something like that so you can light up an otherwise dark area.
Mm.
Now, that basically forces you to choose between going in blind because the area is completely dark with a shield in your left hand, or putting a torch in your left hand and sacrificing that shield so you can see the enemies.
Absolutely. And the moment that you put that shield, that torch away, yeah, it goes out. And you can pull it back out, but until you find another sconce or another bonfire to light it at, you'll be in the dark. So it's kind of an interesting tactical choice, isn't it? Do you sacrifice your light for defense, or do you keep your ability to see? And an interesting little environmental thing we've discovered is that there are dark areas with wooden boards over the windows, for instance, and if you smash the wooden boards with your weapon, light will flood in. So there are ways to handle these, you know, little environmental hazards that are quite interesting, I think.
Mm, the environments in Dark and Demon Souls were always immersive, but this time around they seem like they actually play a part in the game as opposed to just being something pretty to look at. That they're much more imposing in some ways and also a lot more immersive in other ways, because they're going to affect the way you play the game. There's even things like enemies, big scary enemies behind doors that would completely leave you alone if you just walk past them, but if you aggro them, they'll smash through these doors or knock down a pillar. It really excites me. It makes the environment a changing thing rather absolutely than static.
And we know that Dark Souls and even Demon Souls as well was all about shortcuts. You open up an area and you find a shortcut back to one of the main areas, and that allows you to access that area more easily than having to walk the long way around. And maybe they're going to reduce that with the innovation of the bonfires you can warp to at your leisure. But when we talk about like the enemy behind the door that smashes through the door for you, he's opening a shortcut for you. I think that's very, very interesting.
Okay, so that's the way the lighting and the environment seems to have been changed from the last few games. What did you have to add about enemies?
Well, we know from the previous game, for example, you encounter the Balder Knights, and if you understand a bit of the lore, you'll know that the Balder Knights were once crusaders that came to Lordran to discover the nature of the curse afflicting humanity, which makes you become undead and hollowed.
So on that note, I suppose this game is a direct continuation of that theme. You are, again, cursed and staving off this hollowing. So what was that? So the Balder Knights, where did they come from?
They came from some other, you know, distant land, and it's probably mentioned in the game, but I can't think of it immediately. But the point is that they were once just like you. They were crusaders trying to find the cure to the curse afflicting humanity.
Okay.
But ultimately they became hollowed, and we know that the hollows are drawn to the souls that the chosen undead carries, and that's why you have to fight them. And we imagine the same thing's going to happen this time. There's a little bit that's been released about the different areas. So for instance, there are competing cities or competing countries that historically were enemies or allies of Drangleic, where the game takes place. They're called Ferossa, Lindelt, and Olaphus that we know about so far. And they each have their own knights that have come to Drangleic that we imagine, because we're talking about ancient times, by now they're hollows and you'll be fighting them. Interestingly, they talk about what kind of fighting styles they have. So the Silverdrake Knights from Lindelt are users of miracles. We know that the Drangleic Knights from the town which the game takes place in were users of sorceries. So it's bear to assume that you're going to be encountering on a regular basis enemies that throw sorceries and throw miracles at you, which we didn't really see with some exceptions in Dark Souls.
Yeah, so it sounds like what you're describing is that these defined areas are going to have almost their own themes, which, again, we did see in Dark Souls. You know, you had the crystal enemies that were all around the Duke's Archives in Dark Souls, and you know, each area did sort of have its theme, and you would often find like certain enchantments, like lightning enchantments were a big theme in Anor Londo and that kind of stuff. So it sounds as though there may be that similar sort of an idea, except it'll be portrayed through the knights of these different areas as they...
Absolutely. And personally, I'm just really interested in fighting a whole bunch of magic casters. And we know that the enemies in this game come mob-handed. We've seen many people talking about their playthrough of the beta, where they say that one of the AI innovations is that the AIs will wait to attack you in groups. And a whole bunch of people casting Soul Arrow at me is going to be very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah. And very off-putting, I can imagine. On that note, it came out... earlier on when the game had been announced that some of the developers from From had mentioned that it's going to be more accessible for a new player, which threw a lot of people off. They thought, shit, you know, they've changed this game now. It's not going to be what we know from Dark Souls, punishingly difficult. And so a lot of people were turned off by that immediately, but they've since come and readjusted their position on that and explained what they meant. And basically all they were implying is that they've focused on making it easier to get into, but the game is still crushingly difficult, and focusing on that feeling of elation as you overcome just these small hurdles at each step of the way. You know, character development as well as personal development to become a better player.
One thing that I noticed in one of the videos that we watched, which will be in the link dump, is that the player was seen fighting a large group of enemies who were dressed in kind of medieval armor type stuff like you'd expect, but who didn't seem to be hollows. And that never happened in Dark Souls. All the enemies you were fighting either because they were a boss with a particular intention or they were hollows that want to kill you.
Yeah, so no doubt that's got some significant lore implications. I'm not terribly sure what that means yet, but... Yeah, just general mobs. They would look like normal hollowed knights, but as you pointed out, you know, from their face, from what you could see, they didn't appear to be hollow.
Yeah, which and you've got to kind of wonder what's the reason that they would have to attack the protagonist. I find that very interesting. Speaking also of who you're going to run into, there's mention in many of the item descriptions of the famous characters from antiquity. You'll remember from Dark Souls that some of the items talked about Big Hat Logan. Some of the spell descriptions talked about Big Hat Logan. And then ultimately you get to meet Big Hat Logan, which was kind of cool, and I really liked the character. There's mention of some, you know, an executioner called Tiny Gren, or a great smith called Llewellyn, and a great sorcerer called Strahd. And you've got to wonder, with the flowy timeline, the way that time is, you know, unique within the Souls universe, are you going to be able to meet those characters from antiquity, and are they going to be bosses or are they going to be NPCs that help you? I'm really, really interested in seeing how that plays out.
Yeah, cool. So again, another big focus on dripping as much lore out of each item that you find just by reading its descriptions and then extrapolating from that, and eventually, hopefully, even meeting the people that are described in these descriptions for the items. Very, very interesting way of discussing lore in a game. And I think what makes it successful in that regard is that Dark Souls respects you as a player. You know, it doesn't have to spoon feed you. It doesn't have to give you a tutorial at the beginning where it explains every little tiny thing to you and treat you like an infant. And I like that. I really do respect that in the game.
Yeah, look, I really rather agree.
From there, I guess what we have to discuss is the way sort of classes work. And apparently they have class choice at the beginning of the game has more implications. As we all know from the earlier games, that you could choose a class, which is significant for the first hour or so of the gameplay because it would determine the items that you start with and some of the beginning stats. But past about soul level 20, it didn't matter. You could make whatever class you wanted pretty much.
Whereas, but we understand this one is going to have more weight put on the class that you choose. How that's going to play out, I'm not really quite sure. But how do you feel about that in general? Well, that was insightful. Personally, I think...
How do you feel about it, Scott?
Well, I like the fact that you're not bound to anything in Dark Souls. You choose to be a warrior and then you decide 10 minutes later that's a joke, and so you turn into a caster and you don't have to restart the game. And I wonder, when they talk about more weight put on the class you choose, is that going to lock you into a particular doctrine?
Yeah, and it's been discussed that you have the ability to respec your class as well. So that's interesting. If you choose a sorcerer from the beginning and you decide that you want to respec, does it still matter that you chose a sorcerer, or can you completely change all of those stats to now play as a dual wielder?
I'd be interested to see that.
Yeah. And on that note, apparently there's even a mechanic in the game where you can change your gender. I'm not sure why that would be relevant. I know in the Demon Souls games there was unique items like armor items where it would be female only or male only, and if you were the opposite gender, you just... That was it. You couldn't wear them for that playthrough.
Yeah, I've never found any of my male characters looked good in the steel G-strings that RPGs tend to put female characters in.
Just try the chainmail. It really helps flossing between the crack. But yeah, so in this game, it's apparently, again, being confirmed that it doesn't matter what gender you are. There's not going to be specific items like armors that will only work on one specific gender. So I'm not sure why they give you the ability to change.
It's and interestingly, if you look at the list of classes, and I'll run through them very quickly, Bandit, Warrior, Knight, Swordsman, and that's the two-handed dual-wielding fellow, Cleric, Sorcerer, Explorer is a new one.
Fellow?
Well, what's wrong with fellow? He's a fellow of probably, you know, the Royal Society of
England. Dual wielders.
Dual wielding fellow. And if you're not polite to him and call him a fellow, he will cut you with his swords. And interestingly, Deprived comes back. You know, you'll remember Deprived is the class you can start from if you are sadistic or a masochist. And that's got nothing. No weapons, no armor. It's actually described in the description as a nude human.
That tickles me. Nude humans are tickling me.
Nude humans.
Okay, so out of that list, though, you mentioned Explorer.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that
is.
It's
the only class that's unique from the last game.
What do you mean unique from the last game?
Well, we've seen bandits, we've seen warriors, we've seen knights. You know, swordsman is a dual wielder. I suppose that's a unique class, but it plays, I suppose, just like any other sword and board. Minus the board.
It seems like Explorer might speak to that kind of jack of all trades aspect that I was talking about earlier, because the description says, does not excel in any particular area, but comes equipped with many items, allowing them to fight advantageously at the beginning of the game.
Well, it has been confirmed that there's more benefit to exploration in this game. So apparently the game world is approximately a similar size to Dark Souls, but there's going to be more items to discover, more hidden secrets and that kind of stuff. And it's also been acknowledged that item sets and armor sets, some will come with advantages like item discovery will increase, you know, not just poison resist or poise, it's going to actually have effects to your class like that. So it could be that a wanderer or explorer, sorry, will have these sorts of benefits and make them more likely to find items.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that, and we know that, for instance, that some armor sets are going to affect particular things, like what some games call luck, which is your ability to find, you know, it's not just about getting positive rolls on randomized outcomes, but finding items on things.
Yeah, so there's actually a new skill, which seems to be a secondary effect of agility. Is it agility or... Well, agility affects swiftness, which apparently is the time that it takes to pull off things like parries and riposts. And there's another benefit which affects sort of luck, your ability to disable traps. So things like, I guess, the mimics from the last game. Yes. Maybe if you have higher luck or whatever this secondary attribute is called, you won't get attacked by mimics as often, or you'll set off traps.
Which would be nice because the mimics were a hell of a thing.
Oh, they were. It's what, one tiny thing of the game and it changes the way you play forever.
Absolutely.
You know, up to that point, run up to a chest. Excellent. I get a new item. You've discovered the first mimic, and from that point on, every chest is a potential threat.
Speaking of secondary stats, there's one called Break Attack, which I think is really interesting, and it's described as the ability of the player to damage the opponent's equipment. Is it just a PvP thing? It might be something that only goes to PvP, and it's some kind of vindictive way to say, well, my break attack was really high, so even though he beat me a bit, he has to spend a lot of money fixing his stuff up. Or is it the case that you can, especially on bosses, your attacks on them will degrade their armor and degrade their weapons and cause them to fight differently? Because it's relatively unique, I think, for a mostly single-player RPG to have an ability to break your opponent's equipment, specifically laid out. It's interesting.
Yeah, because there was the scraping spear in Demon Souls, which was, as you said, just specifically a PvP item, and it was one to, in a way that only Dark Souls can, allow you to go fuck you to the other players. It was an item that didn't do a lot of damage, but a few hits to somebody else's item or armor and it would degrade it to the point where they had to spend money to repair it later. So it was literally just a way of pissing other players off.
And it's fun to be a dick sometimes. Especially, I've had times in Dark Souls where someone invades me or I invade somebody else and it's the same guy, the same fellow, again and again and again. And
are they a part of the same cleric?
Yeah, they're the same. Yeah, they're there with the dual wield. That's what I'm talking about. These dual wielding fellows.
Okay.
When I invade those dual wielding fellows, if they're particularly, you know, they're jerks and they keep invading me again and again, I want to be able to smash their armor and kind of go, well, up yours. Run back to your hoity-toity English buddies.
Yeah, there's nothing more satisfying than being invaded by the same guy three times, and the first two times he wins, but the third time you get the better of him. And
yeah, but he's still up on points, so he laughs all the way to the friggin'
right, but if you get bonfire. The ability to punish them in some way by degrading their armor,
yeah.
All the better.
And it could even be an insurance policy. I've been invaded by the same person again and again, but if they have to run off to fix their armor, they can't invade me again.
I suppose, yeah, yeah. And on that note, there's been mention of ways of punishing people that are invading over and over again. So there's going to be a covenant that sounds potentially like the Dark Moons, I think.
Dark Wraiths?
No, that's the Dark Moon Blades, where they would basically punish other players that have done policemen. Bad in the world. Yeah, so it sounds like sort of a policeman kind of a class. So it's not just about constantly invading over and over to piss people off, which is I like.
I ran into a really interesting item description earlier that I think is worth reading. We know that a lot of the lore in this game and the storyline comes from reading item descriptions and understanding the relationships between the characters that are mentioned there. And a lot of the ones in this game are really, really cryptic. And some of that is because they're referring to characters you encountered in Dark Souls. You know, they say a famous archer and they mean a particular guy. And
Faris.
Yeah, exactly. They, you know, they talk about Faris's hat, but they never mention Faris by name. Listen to
which this. Is a part of the whole timeline being skewed, you know. So obviously they talk about things from antiquity where it's a part of the game and the lore of the game, but it's sort of lost to history.
I'm really intrigued by this one. The item description says this. Great sword belonging to a man known as the Pursuer, known as the mightiest of the straight swords. It also asks great strength and dexterity of its wielder. The sword was held one-handed by its previous owner, but now is not the time to discuss him.
I like that.
What does that
now
mean?
Now is not the time to discuss him.
Is it ever the time to discuss him? You read the damn thing at your leisure. You wait an hour and read it again, and it's still not the damn time. Bloody drive me ballistic. But no, I like it's so cryptic. I really love the way that the lore is not spoon-fed to you.
Mm, and on that note, there's a weapon called the ladle, which is quite literally just a spoon.
Yeah, so you can spoon-feed defeat to your opponents.
Now, a few changes to the UI, which I really like. You have the ability to wear four rings, apparently, this time.
Yeah, because doesn't that drive you ballistic in video games when you can only wear one ring? You've got 10 fingers. And if the ring gives you magic powers, I'd wear them on my toes.
Round your waist if you could.
Yeah.
So, four rings and 10 quick slots for items. Dark Souls had 5. You could toggle through them by pressing down on the D-pad. This one has the ability to have 10. The way they've sort of modified things to make that work better, I think, is you can see the next item that's going to come up when you press down. So you can see what's coming up and sort of counter for that and know what's in your next slot. On top of that, you also are able to carry 3 weapons in each hand, apparently, now.
Well, weapons, catalysts, shields.
Sure. So I don't know that I fully got that. I suppose in Dark Souls, you can swap between 2 different weapons or shields in each hand. Now you can swap through 3.
Yeah. And I mean, I said before, weapons, catalysts, shields. There are some things that are all 3. There's mention of these 3 sacred bells, and they're not the same, I think, as the 2 bells that were in Dark Souls.
Maybe a nod, but they seem to be unique actual items.
And do they? It's described as a sacred bell within Dark Souls 2. What does that mean? We don't know. But one of them is called the disc bell. It's a catalyst for doing sorceries, and it's a shield. And it's a weapon because we know that you can use your shields as weapons now. So I think it's really interesting. It totally changes the game dynamic. And not having to have a catalyst that you change to in your offhand when you use the shield, how handy is that going to be? It's going to be excellent.
Hmm. Okay. So I think that's the core stuff. A couple of minor little points that you might want to touch on. Headshots stun enemies, which I suppose allows you to then run up and backstab them because they're stunned, or you can riposte them from there, apparently.
Yeah, you can parry when you are two-handing a weapon, which only makes sense. You should have always been able to do that. So it's nice that they've put that in there.
Mm. Classes are starting with lower stats. So again, not sure how that's going to play in entirely because I suppose when I hear lower stats, that says to me you have more customization because you get to choose where to put your points when you level up. But as we've acknowledged, classes are apparently more important than the last few games.
Exactly. And speaking of upgrading and points, that's one of the reasons that I think we love RPGs, is you get some kind of gratification out of working towards a goal and then getting to choose how your character develops. That is going to be much expanded, we hear. We understand there's going to be a poison upgrade path. Now, whether that means poison upgrade class on weapons or poison upgrade class on a person, we're not actually quite sure yet. The language is a bit ambiguous. But I think it's really interesting that they're going to expand the way that you customize your character. I mean, it's exactly what you want out of an RPG, isn't it?
And also, starting gifts return, but apparently they're quite different to the last. There's not going to be things like Master Key, but there will apparently be an item that makes the game more difficult. So not entirely sure what that means yet. I think they mentioned that you need to choose to burn it at a bonfire, so it might be like a per run sort of a basis.
And how many noobs that didn't bother to listen to a podcast like this or read anything about it are going to burn it in the bonfire anyway and then discover that the game's become even harder than they...
Dark Souls, how I love you. Okay. So is there anything else that you wanted to sort of touch on these quick hit points?
Hit points? This isn't Twitch Plays Pokemon, buddy. No.
So I think if you stick with us, we'll expand on a lot of these points that we've sort of speculated on now as we go through. Our next episode will likely be a first impressions thing. It might not be a full length, but it will release a day or two after the game's release. Hopefully, I've already organized to have my day off work. How about you?
Yeah, I'm definitely taking a day off to do that. My boss didn't hear me say that, though. I think it's worth noting that we want your feedback. So we want you to buy the game when it comes out, and we want you to play it, and we want to have a relationship with our listeners where we're talking about the lore that we've interpreted and the way that we're playing the game, and you send us an email and say, hey, well, I think the lore is this way, and we can have a chat about the way that this works. Because as we saw in the last game, the lore was interpreted and written down by the players. It wasn't written down by the people that made the game. Very, very interesting. So I think it's worth having that kind of reciprocal relationship.
Absolutely. So we have been the Dark Souls 2.
Yep. I'm Church. This is Taboo. And thank you very much for listening. Listen out for our first impressions. Buy the game, play it with us, and enjoy. It's going to be amazing.
We'll see you next week.
The Dark Souls 2 has been a Screaming and Digital production. For show notes, please visit thedarksouls2.com or join the community at facebook.com/thedarksouls2. You can also contact us via info@thedarksouls2.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or spread the word.